Alan Kring Productions, in association with Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance FIL 240 for spring semester 2026.
Today, analysis of financial statements and ratios combined. And again, there will be an Excel file you will use. It is in your files folder, and I'll guide you to where you get that here in just a little while. But first, we have a look at the numbers, as always. And as you can see, right now, well, I've been doing enough of saying this on my own, so let me give it, see if I can ask you, sir, is this a, looking at the U.S. market, is this a bull or a bear day? Good. It's a, don't ask a question, just say bear. You know, don't show me weakness. Bulls and bears sense weakness, okay? So yeah, you can see that it's actually been tailing downward through the day. It's just like the mood has gotten more and more sour as the hours have clicked along since the opening bell. It started out, you know, pretty much flat from where it closed yesterday, and it's just been kind of letting up all through the day. But we'll go over to the markets on the other side of the world. And as you can see, the Nikkei, yeah, we're getting here, the, where, oh, I'm going to have to pull this. Oh, no, I'm good. The Nikkei, it went down, the Nikkei 225, and it went down enough that we noticed it. It's 0.75%. That's not a huge down day, but it's enough to get our attention. And we've seen a series of bear days over in Tokyo. And then you go along and you can look at the Hang Seng. It's just been sort of bouncing, barely negative, barely positive. And then it finally finished up just a minuscule 0.05%, which is basically saying that it was flat for through the flat. And then you look at a couple of others. Australia, it had a pretty seriously down day, but I noticed that some of these are still flashing, so that might be aftermarket activity over there. But anyway, nothing exciting there. Go over to Europe. That would be the middle column, and Great Britain. And you'll see that, well, it's not really anything. The CAC was up actually a lot. Well, it was up more than 1%. So Paris was in a good mood, apparently. And then you've got Euronext was up a little bit. That's like a composite index from around the European Union. And the DAX was down a little bit. So, but the Financial Times, one thing I noticed about this one is that notice how it crested. It went up and up, and then there was a little sell-off. Right about at the end, it sold off some. But it still ended the day above where it began the day at 0.85% up. So it was a bull day over there in Europe. So we had not the greatest day on the other side of the in Asia. A pretty decent day over in Europe. Now we come over here and we see that the Dow is right now, it started up. You notice there was a bull market and then it started to tail downward as some the news got more and more sour as the day has been going along. The S&P 500 was bearish from the very beginning and right now it's down more than 0.75%. And the NASDAQ is down quite a bit at negative 1.86%. So in other words, the negative news is more significant the less size the company has. Dow seems to be, well, a little, not very much down, but then the S&P 500 reacting more as it usually does is down more, and then the NASDAQ, which reacts the most, was down the most. So now let me show you over here what, and this goes back to what I was talking about before. You notice that gold is beginning to show muscle again. It had a rally there, and then it kind of lost the rally. But gold actually did punch above $5,000 an ounce a few hours ago, and it's lost a little of its steam right now. But as I told you before, there was a huge sell-off in gold and silver last week, and everyone was kind of laughing, see, that wasn't anything. No, it's like I said, there is pressure upward on gold, and it's because of the long-term, very dire look the economy has. And more numbers are showing that, yeah, there is definitely indications that we're already in a recession, and it's going to get bad before it gets any better, if it ever does get better again here in the U.S. So, here's a very troubling thing, is that crude and light sweet are both up. We're beginning to see upward pressure on oil prices, and it probably will continue. And it's not on worries about war in the Middle East. It is that we are beginning to see what the long-term strategy of the OPEC nations was. The strategy was create a huge supply of oil that will drive down the price per barrel of crude, Brent, any kind of oil. Once you've kept it down long enough, all of the smaller oil producers are going to be out of business. And then once they're chased away, then the oil supply from OPEC will begin to shrink. And there won't be any competitive pressure from smaller producers because they're gone. And then they will just cut off the oil to the extent that they need to get the price back up to $80, $90 a barrel. So we're beginning to probably beginning to see the very first hints of the contraction of the oil supply, which will drive the price of crude oil up, and that will mean gasoline will get to be more expensive down the road. But for now, we're still in a good zone. Gasoline prices are still low. That won't last very long once crude oil breaks above $70 a barrel. Now, light sweet Brent is just about there now. We're about halfway to $70 on just the average of crude. It's at about $65 a barrel now. So the first stop on the way to perdition, that is to hell, is when we see crude oil break 70. It'll probably go up and down, but it'll be working its way towards 70 over the next couple of weeks. We hope that that won't last for long. As you can see, though, as you had said, this is a bear market today, and that's what we're seeing. See how the sector map is mostly red today? That's your clearest indication of all that we've got a bear day. Even the technology stocks were down today, and that's pretty odd because those stocks seem to have a life of their own. They're always going up. So if you've got a bear day in the technology sector, then that's a kind of a serious, it means that the bears are serious today. They're not messing around at all. Now, let me take you over here. Let me show you the numbers for the company I'm going to work with. Now, on Monday, I pulled up Palantir. As I looked at it more and more, I think I mentioned this on Monday, its financials are pointing to a very odd kind of company. It's not a normal company at all. Palantir is in the business of collecting and selling data, information. It hasn't got a physical product. What it has is numbers on you, on me, on everyone. It collects all kinds of information, and then it sells those as essentially a broker. It sells your information to the government, to corporations, to other entities on the global and national stage. And so its financials are a new kind of animal out there. And kind of honestly with you, traditional financial analysis isn't all that prepared to look at companies like this. Our ratios lean toward companies that actually create something, do something, other than just collect electrons in servers and then shoot them out to the highest highest bidder. So I'm avoiding Palantir until we've got a better handle on what we use to analyze its its financials, its ratios to determine the health of the company. So today, nevertheless, despite the fact that we are in this information age, a lot of our daily lives are still centered around physicality of products that are created by these companies. And one of the classics of that is Colgate-Palmolive. It's just a company that's been around for a very long time. It creates things that you, almost everyone in this room, would have some one or more products that have Colgate-Palmolive as their producer. And as you can see, it is a distinctly bold day for this company. Even in the face of a bear day overall, Colgate-Palmolive is up almost 2%. And that's something to be said when you've got a strongly bear day going on in on the street. And as you can see, it had a very serious jump here, and we can trace that back easily. But let me see if they've got their earnings. Do they have? Yeah, they beat their earnings, and that was, they beat their earnings. So what you can see is, as soon as they announced that they beat their earnings estimate, see how they estimated that the earnings would be here, and they were well up above that there? Well, that means that the market was caught a little bit off guard, and so the price shot up on this new information. And it even rose a little more when they, as the market analysts began to absorb it and saw just how good that was. And so it's having a nice, strong day, in spite of the fact that the street itself, the markets are in bear territory. The simple fact that Colgate-Palmolive beat its earnings estimate when it did its earnings call, that was enough for a lot of buying activity. Oh, this company is better than we thought it was. And so the market participants bought shares and drove the price up. And now you see how it's kind of leveling off here. In other words, all of this is the absorption of the information that was in that earnings report. And that information was positive, and that's why you see that information, just like a physical propellant in an airplane or a rocket ship, it lifts it up, it accelerates it. And it's classical Newtonian physics. Inertia is overcome by a force, and the force was pushed, it was a positive force, so it lifted it up. And now it's going to settle down. Probably it'll bounce around here. There may be a little sell-off here, you know, profit taking and all that. But other than that, good news. And the interesting thing is, when you look at Colgate-Palmolive's financial statements, you kind of say to yourself, well, this is odd. But without further ado, I want you to go over here, and I'm going to keep this up here. I want you to go over to your canvas, and I will just chill here for a few minutes. Go to your canvas and go to files in Canvas. And like I said, I'll give you a time to catch up with me here so I'm not rolling all over you as we go along. An important back note, I do these Excel sheets to get you comfortable with using Excel. I know a number of you have used it, and the thing here is that I'm taking you up a little bit of a level in what you can do. You can make Excel a multifaceted tool that can do a lot of different things. And that's one of the reasons I require the certification, as has been put down to all of us professors by the dean, that we want everyone certified in Excel by the time they get out of their bachelor's degree. And this is part of that. It's just getting you comfortable with it. Go to your files. Now go to spreadsheets and go to class spreadsheets. Now everything I'm going to do today, I'm going to save in the same file, Colgate-Palmolive. so that you can pull this up later if you stumble trying to keep up with me or something like that. You have this to, you'll have it all from the lecture today for your use. Now, remember that when you're downloading files, do not click on the Word link. You go over here to the three dots and you download it. Because otherwise, all you get is really an image if you just click on the link itself, on the words. And then we're going to pull this up here. Maybe. And I'm going to widen it. Whoops. And enable editing. So now we're ready to go with Colgate-Palmolive. And these were pulled off Standard & Poor's Global Net Advantage just a few hours ago. So I'd have anything that was new, I'd get the freshest that they had. And as you can see, it opens on the income statement. Now the three sheets that are always going to be the most useful in finance are the income statement, the balance sheet, and the statement of cash flows. These will always be the ones that we are running to get this, that, or the other thing. Now, the next thing I want to do is this company, Standard & Poor's Global Net Advantage gives you the ratios. We're just going to go back through here and we're going to do the physical calculation of them. Here, and so I want to put a insert a worksheet between the income statement and the balance sheet, and I'll call it ratios one, so it has a different name from the ones that are already in this spreadsheet. One thing before I proceed any further in this is that I will definitely want to go back to my files folder at the top of it and pull down that financial analysis ratios sheet right here. Now, as I had told you, well, let's try that again. Download it. Now, as I told you, you print this out and you can use it on quizzes and on the midterm exam and the final exam. I'm not in this to have you memorize all these ratios when we can just look them up anytime we want anyway. It's not worth it. But what I do want you to do is understand what the ratios are telling us. And we'll go through this. One set of ratios at a time. And we'll make some comments along the way. I'll be telling you, so make sure you write down what the meaning of these ratios is. And as is my usual tradition here, I will want to make 2025, 2024, 2023, I think I get 20 clear through 2021, I think, and 2022, sorry about that, and 2021. And keeping in mind that once we get the calculation done in the first row, in the first column, we can just copy and paste and it will carry over the calculation to all the previous years in line with what you see on these financial statements. So it looks like a lot of calculations, but it's not nearly as many. And once we have gotten all those in, we can start talking about trends in the ratios. But for now, the ratios. I start with the liquidity ratio. Liquidity ratios. And under this one, I have the current ratio, the quick ratio, which is oftentimes called the acid test, and then we have the cash ratio, which used to be called the burn ratio. Now, what these ratios are doing is telling you about the ability of this company to meet its short-term obligations with its short-term assets. The first one is simply saying, what are the current assets divided by the current liabilities? So I type in the column B3 equals, and I go to the balance sheet and I find the current assets, total current assets, which is 5709. And I sit divided by, and then I cruise down to find the current liabilities, total current liabilities, which is 5736. And then I hit enter and it takes me over. Here's an interesting thing in this one. This number is almost exactly one. It's 0.9962 something. That means that the current assets can cover the current liabilities about one time over. They're very close to even. This is kind of something that I see in older companies. Companies that aren't quite as old, you can see the number up above 1.25, 1.5, or even below 1.75, 0.8. Here they are doing old school. Current assets should equal current liabilities. Now the quick ratio says, okay, sure, the quick ratio says, yeah, okay, current assets. But the current assets include assets that really aren't very liquid, especially inventory. You couldn't turn inventory into cash in a very quick fashion. And even if you did, you would have to give up a lot of money to dump your inventory. So this one, I say equals, and I open parentheses, and I go back to the balance sheet, and I say, I click on the total current assets, but then I subtract inventory, which is 2032. And then I close the parentheses, and now I divide it by the total current liability. 5736. Now you notice now, taking out that not so liquid inventory, our current assets can only cover the current liabilities about 0.64 times. Put another way, the more liquid assets, that excludes inventory, could cover about 64% of our current liabilities. Now the last one says, at the end of the day, the only thing, if you had to immediately pay all of your current liabilities today, the only thing that's real is your cash. So now I'll go back to the balance sheet and I'll say, okay, equals, and I'll just go up here to where my cash is. And I'm usually, this is something of a controversial thing. It always has been. Do I just use cash and equivalents, or do I also include things like short-term investments? The answer nowadays is short-term investments can be liquidated with a push of a button. So I tend to say, just use total cash and short-term investments, the 1395 for the denominator. In that case, let's try that again. That one didn't work out. We'll say equals your short-term cash. Oops, I meant that one. Short-term cash, total cash and short-term investments divided by your total current liabilities. So if you had to pay off all of your current liabilities within a couple of days, you could cover about 24% of them. That's just the reality. And that's not unusual. But, by the way, as a side note, get this in your notes. The units in which these liquidity ratios are cast is the little time symbol. They are essentially, they are multiplied. In other words, your current assets can cover your current liabilities 0.995 times and all of that. And if you just, if you've never seen this before, if you want to use symbols, you can format the cells and you do a custom job. And what I would do here is I would say, I don't know. This is how you would format, if you wanted to do it the professional way, to two decimal places, and then space X. That'll create, now if you try to type a word in there, Excel will think it's a word, not a number. But if you do it by the customization way, it actually will put anything you want, pounds, meters, kilograms, anything you want, and it will still know it as a number. Let me show you that trick again. And again, this is one of those sessions where I'm showing you all of the subtle nuances that are part of using Excel professionally. I format the cells, and I go to custom, and I delete that general, and I say, okay, I want two decimal places of accuracy, 0.00, and then I put quotation marks, and then I put a space and a time symbol. And I'll show it to you again. And you can put anything in there, LB, MI, anything you want, label it. And it will, Excel will still say, oh, that's a number with just some weird stuff on it. Again, one more time, format the cells and custom. And then I get rid of the general and I say, okay, 0.00, excuse me, tells Excel to use two decimal places and also put a space and a little time symbol after it. And that'll give you that number with whatever, you know, units of measure you want. And I'm not going to do that after this until towards the end. Okay, I've got the sneezes again. Okay, now let's do the profitability ratios. Profitability ratios, the ones that I will be caring about in this class, will be the gross margin, the operating margin, and the net margin. Now, in all of these, we are measuring how much of a dollar going into the cash register survived. So in the gross margin, we're seeing how much of a dollar of revenue survived wholesale costs. So we'll say equals, and we go over here to the income statement this time, and we're going to take our gross profit divided by our revenue. So this tells us that 60 cents of every dollar made it past your wholesale costs. So in other words, they're paying about 40 cents per dollar on what they buy to sell. And then operating margin is the same, except I'm going to take equals the operating expense, operating profit. Go back to the income statement. Now I go down here to operating income, 4291, and I divide that by revenue. Now this is saying, okay, how much of every dollar survived wholesale costs and all of your other operating expenses? point to about 21 cents. And then the net margin, okay, how much of every dollar survived to the bottom line? That bottom line is what the shareholders, what belongs to the shareholders. So, and in this case, I would say net margin is equal to, I will take it clear down here to net income. Come on, where the heck is net income? Come on. Net income, right? Clear down here at, in the income statement, at B59, 2132. And then I divide that by the revenue. 10 cents. Actually, that's not bad. 10 cents. You see companies all over the place. Service companies, the net margin is way up there. But a lot of industrial companies, that could be 1 cent, 3 cents. It's not a lot for some companies. Here, for Colgate-Palmolive, of every dollar that came into the cash register, 10 cents of that gets to the shareholders. Now, the shareholders, the company can give that to them as dividends, or it can plow that money back into the company, into operations, hopefully to make the company grow. You never know, though. Okay, the next ones that we'll do here, I think what I'll do is I'll attack the asset activity ratios. Oh, whoa. I'm sorry. I missed two important ones here in profitability. Return on assets and return on equity. Now, these two measures, if you think about the total assets of the company as being like a portfolio, how much did that portfolio earn? And then you turn that around and say, okay, if we ignore what is not doesn't belong to the shareholders and focus only on what the portfolio of shareholders' wealth is bringing in, that would be ROE, return on equity. Now, return on assets, you're going to take net income and you will divide that, clear down here again. Come on, clear down net income, 2132. And this time we're going to divide it by total assets. So this time we have to jump over to the balance sheet and get total assets, which are 16,330. So the ROA of the company is 0.13, 13%. The company as a portfolio earned 13%. Now, if we focus only on what the shareholders have contributed through buying the stock and letting the company push money back in instead of paying its dividends, we would have equals, and in this case, we would look at net income. Again, going over to the income statement and find that stupid net income, 2132, divided this time by, go to the balance sheet, and do return on total equity, 365. Try that one more time. That can't be right. Equals net income. Let me do that again. 2132 divided by the balance sheet, total equity. Oh, that's insane. Yeah, I was. That can't possibly be right. 584%? Oh, baloney. I'm not even going to look at that. Okay, ROE will always be at least as large as ROA. And that's because of this. This is a classic question for a quiz or an exam. But return on assets is net income divided by total assets. Return on equity is net income divided by shareholders' equity. Here's the thing. Total assets is liabilities plus equity. Shareholders' equity is just part of total assets. So the denominator of ROE is smaller than the denominator of ROA. That's why this ROE will be a bigger number by definition than the ROA. ROE will always exceed ROA. In fact, there is kind of a nasty trick that, a problem, I should say, with looking at these numbers. ROA depends on how much total assets the company has. If a company does not replace its assets in a timely manner, the total assets number will go down. You depreciate it away and you don't replace it with new fixed assets, then your total assets will be constantly going downward, which means that ROA would keep going upward. Without any effort of the company is just simply not replacing assets. That has been a problem with companies where we see their ROA going up and up, but it's because they are not replacing assets as well as they should. And so you can see that ROA getting bigger, and therefore ROE getting bigger, simply because the company is not reinvesting sufficiently. And that is something that we have to watch out for if ROA is going up too fast. We ask ourselves, okay, let's look at their fixed assets. Are they replacing fixed assets or are they just letting them depreciate away in their portfolio, in their asset portfolio? But anyway, these numbers are all percents, which are easy to put in. Just hit the percent key and then you slip it over a couple of decimal places. I still don't get that. That's insane, that ROE. There we are. Okay. Now, taking it over here to asset activity. Now, the ones that I will focus on, and I'll bring this sheet back up for you with asset activity. The ones that are most interesting for a class like this, and actually for all of us, are total asset turnover, fixed asset turnover, and inventory turnover. So I mentioned last class the ones that you can ignore, like average collection period, day sales outstanding, inventory turnover, and days inventory held. The ones that I will focus on are total asset turnover, fixed asset turnover, and inventory turnover. So we'll do go back here, and I'll type these out. Total asset turnover, fixed asset turnover. Try that again. Fixed asset turnover and inventory turnover. Now, total asset turnover is sales over total assets. So the thing we have to bounce first over to income statement and get our revenues. Total revenues, 2382 divided by, run over to the balance sheet, total assets. 16,330. So they turned over their entire value of their assets about 1.24 times in 2025. Similarly, their fixed assets, we would take total sales equals revenue. Again, total revenue, 2382, this time divided by just their fixed assets. Oh, Lord. Net property, plant, and equipment is the one we usually use for this. Those are the fixed assets. And that gives us, what do you mean? Don't talk to me like, sorry. Excel and I have a very complicated relationship. Let's try that again. Fixed assets equals total sales, which is 2382, divided by their balance sheet, their total net property, plant, and equipment, 4660. There we go. So they turned their entire fixed asset, property, plant, and equipment, over as if it were a portfolio more than four times. So they were doing it about every 3 months, approximately. Inventory turnover, we're going to take net sales. Is that right? No, it's not. Let me do something here. Let me look at this. Cost of goods sold. I knew I was going to run too far with that. Inventory turnover is cost of goods sold. Equals cost of goods sold from the income statement, 8131, divided by inventory. Where's their inventory? Come on. There we go. 2032. So they turned over their warehouses, turned over everything in the warehouses four times last year. In other words, about every 3 months, they had cleared inventory and replaced it. That's not bad. Now, a lot of these new age kinds of gurus will say, well, that should be 12 or 20 or... Colgate's not doing that. They are turning it over at a reasonable pace every 3 months. Not every month, not every 2 weeks, about four times a year. Everything in their inventory is cleared and replaced with new inventory. So for what it's worth. Okay, now the next one that we're probably going to want to do are the debt ratios. In other words, leverage ratios. Now the debt management. Now the debt management ratios are, the first one is debt to total assets. Total assets. Now, I'll say something about this, total assets. In other words, what we're going to do here is we're going to take the company's debt, and the way you do this, and I think your book says to do this too, is we go to the balance sheet. Well, let me do something here. Ratios equals. Now go to the balance sheet. Now what you're going to see a lot of debt things in here. The one that you use is long-term debt. That's all you do, long-term debt. Don't get fogged by any other numbers you see in there, just long-term debt. And then you divide that by your total assets. Well, that's a little surprising. This company is almost half debt. That's a surprisingly, I wouldn't have expected that. And a lot of times I like to do these on the fly so you can hear my first impression. And in this one, I mean, this is an old company and they are leveraged almost half debt. Like I said, that's a little unusual for an old, especially for an old company, to have that much debt in their capital structure. Now, I'm going to give you a definition here. Capital structure is the combination of debt and equity that comprises total assets. Capital structure is the combination of debt and equity that comprises total assets. Capital structure is the combination of debt and equity that comprises total assets. So the capital structure of Colgate here is about 49% debt, 51% equity. I put a little bit more loosely. Colgate-Palmolive's capital structure shows a noticeable leverage. That'd be kind of a sophisticated way of doing it, if you're into sophisticated language. I would say that the capital structure of Colgate-Palmolive shows a noticeable amount of leverage. And like I said, I mean, that's a little surprising to me, but there you are. Now, the next one I want to do is times interest earned. This is how many times over the money they have that could pay interest can pay it. So let me show you. Times interest earned. And I'm going to take equals, and this will be on the income statement. I'm going to take their operating income. That's how much money they have right before they pay interest. Divided by, now I have to do the absolute value of this one, ABS, because they always put that in as a negative, and that makes your result come out. So I'll just put in, this net interest expense is 192, the absolute value of the negative there. And the only reason I'm doing that is because almost all companies report that as a negative number, but we want the ratio to be positive, so I just do that. This is really surprising to me. Let me go back and make sure I did that right. Equals operating income. This is how much money they have right before they pay interest, divided by the absolute value of the net interest expense. That's actually a very large number. They can pay their interest with what they got to pay interest 22 times over. Now, a lot of companies are in like 6, 8, 12. This company can pay its interest 22 times over, and yet it has a large amount of debt in its capital structure. Those two almost don't make sense together, and that would take some deep digging to see how they could have that much money to pay interest and yet have that much debt they have to pay interest on. One way or the other, whatever. Now we go over here. This is EBITDA, EBITDA. EBITDA is when you take the net operating income and you add back depreciation and amortization. Because depreciation and amortization are actually real numbers. So if we looked at EBITDA here, and I'll have to watch carefully when I do this. I'm going to look back at their income statement. Do they have, yeah, there it is, right there, depreciation and amortization. What? They don't have any depreciation and amortization? Ha! Huh. Isn't that odd? Wouldn't you expect a company like this to have depreciation? It's not. There's none there. Let me look real quick over their statement of cash flows. They have depreciation. There it is. Look at that. It's not being reported on the income statement, but there it is. That's interesting. So what I would have to do here, and I promise you I would not, oops, times EBITDA earned. And again, I would not ask you to do this. This is too much like work. But what I will, but I'll show it to you here. You would take equals, and you would take your operating income right here, and then you would add back depreciation and amortization, which is over here on the statement of cash flows. I wonder why they don't have it in their income statement. Then divide that by how much interest they owe. Income statement, interest expense. I screwed that up because I didn't put the absolute value. So it'll be a negative. Let me put an absolute value on that one. ABS, open parentheses, close it over here. That'll make it a positive number. Okay, 25, almost 26 times over if you don't take into account non-operating non-cash flow items. Okay, one more or the other. Let me finish this up here real quick. I did debt management, asset activities, market values. Now, the market values, as I had told you before, the market values, you have to go and chase down a price for the stock right now and to get the PE ratio. The same as price to free cash flow. You'd have to chase down the actual market price right now. There is one here that I do want to, I want to do, but I know I'm going to be sorry if I do it. Market to book. You take the market cap divided by the book value of shareholders' equity. Now, I'm going to be very sorry I did this because I know I'm going to get the units wrong in this. But let me do market ratios. And the one that I'll do is market to book. And I know I'm going to be sorry I did this. And what I'll have to do is put in the number manually. I'll go over to Colgate-Palmolive. There's the market cap right there. The company is worth $76.789 billion. So I'll have to put that number in manually. However, I've got to watch the units in this. And I'm not going to do this to you on a quiz or an exam because it's just, if you make a mistake, you're in real bad trouble. But I go over here. Let me look at their balance sheet. Now, the accountants say that the total value of shareholders' equity is 54. But I think that is in... It doesn't even tell me. It's got to be, is that in millions or is that in billions? I'm thinking that that number is in billions. Yeah, it's, that's in billions. No, it couldn't be. See, there's a problem is that I've got the market cap in billions and I am not even sure of what that 54 is. Is that billions? Is that millions? Is that hundreds of millions? I'm almost thinking that that's in hundreds of millions. 5,400 million, 5.4 billion. I'm guessing, and I don't hold me to that. And I, again, one of the things that I do in teaching is show you when I'm in a lost place, I don't fake it. I want you to see. I'm guessing that the market cap, the billions in the market cap here, 76.789 divided by, come over here to the balance sheet, and that was a 54. So I'm thinking that that's 5.4 billion. Oops, equals. I am, so yeah, that's right. That is right. So the market to book is about 14.22 times. In other words, the market is saying that every dollar of accounting equity is actually worth $14.22 in market value. In other words, every dollar that the shareholders have contributed through buying the stock, through giving up dividends to plow back into operations, that has become, so far, $14.22. Let me say that again. Every dollar that the shareholders have put into this company through buying the stock, through not getting dividends and letting the company put their money back into the company, has turned into $14.22. That's the best way to describe it. So this company has, all along the way, been magnifying every dollar of shareholder contribution more than 14 times. And I'm not going to hold that, you to that. I want you to just kind of think about it. I'll talk more about it as time goes along. But there you are. Now we're going to do one last thing here. See all these numbers here? I'm just going to copy and paste. I'm just going to drag them over to F. Look at that. I've gotten all of these years. And then I can just go back and I can kind of lull my way through. See how their current ratio? They were getting more and more liquid. And then they got a little too liquid. And then they came back up. The quick ratio kind of shows the same pattern, actually a little more dramatically. And their cash ratio, notice how their cash ratio has stayed about the same over the years. How much cash relative to total current liabilities. Going down here, do you notice how their gross margin has been fairly stable over the years? Around in this area right here, they seem to be getting a little bit less cost for their wholesale goods. But overall, it's been pretty stable. And I deliberately use a company like Colgate-Palmolive because you do see that stability in their ratios. This is a window looking in to management. How good do they control their ratios? You see these companies, especially younger companies, their ratios from 1 year to the next are bouncing all over the place. These ratios are staying under control. One of the reasons the company has a low beta. And if I look at this one's kind of bounced around. Their net profit margin has bounced around a little bit. It was pretty spectacular last year, which was kind of out of line. Notice how 2024 was kind of unusual. They had a very good profit margin, and now it's kind of settled back down more to maybe more a little in line with what it usually is. ROA has been staying. Notice here, their ROA dropped from 24 to 25. That would most likely be the result of significant fixed asset in investments. which makes the total assets bigger, which makes the ROA lower. That's actually healthy. And that return on equity is just stupid. I can't even explain that. That's okay. The one I want to look at here is inventory turnover. You notice that that has stayed quite stable over the years. Pretty stable. In other words, they have a pace at which they get inventory moved from warehouse to shelves to sale. And it doesn't really change too much over time. They're not in the business of increasing that asset turnover ratio. They do things their way, and it's been going on for a long time with this company. Now, notice that their leverage, their capital structure has stayed fairly stable. It was a little high back here, and it looks like they paid down some of their long-term debt, paid them off, and then kept it back, and then they've brought it back up a little bit here. But it's fairly stable. This isn't an accident. They are a leveraged company. They have a noticeable amount of leverage. They're not trying to bring that leverage down. They're just keeping it the same. And as a result, they're getting good interest. They don't pay a huge amount of interest, so they've got a lot of money left over. Now, let me go down here, market to book. Notice how their market to book has stayed very stable over the years. In other words, how much they deliver on every dollar of shareholder investment stays about the same. This is, again, you're seeing the reasons behind that low beta on this stock. That is not an accident. This company is old and these numbers are stable. Those are the kinds of things that serious investment funds, pension funds, trust funds, conservative investors just love, is because this company is not out there flying fighter planes into the unknown. It maintains management iron fist over operations in this company. And that is the kind of thing that you want if you don't want to put your investment money at risk. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.